This is Radio Moscow.
Good evening, everybody. We are transmitting on 6.02, 7.24, 7.36, 11.89, and 15.23 megacycles per second. These are the frequencies on which we broadcast daily from 20 minutes past 6 until half past 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. At half past 7, three frequencies are dropped. 7.36, 11.89, and 15.23 megacycles. We continue broadcasting until 9 p.m. on 6.02, 7.24, and also on 9.48 megacycles per second. The last frequency is added. First, here's a schedule of the programs we are presenting in this transmission. We begin with the news, followed by a review of the day's papers, and then a commentary written for us today by Shatilov on the relations between the Soviet Union and the small countries of Eastern Europe. 6:45, a program of recordings made by Fyodor Shalyapin. This program is arranged as a tribute to the great Russian singer on the 9th anniversary of his death. 7:10, today's edition of the Sidelights on Soviet Life program, reviewing a new play by Konstantin Simonov, The Russian Question, which is now playing at the Moscow Theater of the Lenin Komsomol. 7:30, our second news edition, including an item from today's Pravda, describing how a group of foreign correspondents interviewed students at the Moscow University. 7:40, a commentary on topics of the day by Chernyavsky. 7:45, an interlude of recorded music in which you hear the singers Mikhail Alexandrovich and Irene Maslenikova, and David Oistrakh, violinist, plays the fourth movement from Lalo's Spanish Symphony. 8:10, the Sidelights on Soviet Life program is repeated at this time. 8:30, we give you our final news edition, which includes the commentary by Shatilov. 8:45, a short interlude of light music, bringing this transmission to a close a few minutes before 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. We say goodnight with the Soviet anthem. So these are our programs from Moscow for this evening. This is Radio Moscow, and here's the news. At the beginning of April, after an exchange of letters between Menon, the Indian ambassador in China, and Petrov, the Soviet ambassador in China, it was agreed that the Soviet government and the government of India published the following official statement simultaneously in Moscow and in Delhi. Striving for the preservation and further strengthening of the friendly relations existing between the Soviet Union and India, the government of the USSR and the government of India have decided to exchange diplomatic representatives with the rank of ambassador. Dozens of factories are once more turning out agricultural machinery. This year, Soviet machine and tractor stations will get over 30,000 tractors, and in 1948, 75,500. Next year's tractor output will be nearly double that of 1937, the peak pre-war tractor production year. Combine output this year will be nearly 8,000. Next year, the figure is to reach 25,000. This year, Soviet agriculture will receive 150,000 tractor and horse plows, 115,000 cultivators of various types, over 70,000 tractor and horse seeders, 50,000 horse-drawn harvesters, and 58,000 mowers. By the end of 1950, there will be not less than 238 types of agricultural machines turned out, as compared with 89 types in 1946. This year, the number of automobiles available for agriculture will increase by 40,000, and in 1948 by 60,000. Black Sea navigation is running full schedules now, and the navigation of the Sea of Azov has begun. Freights are to increase more than 15% as compared with last year. New freight lines are opening, and sea traffic between Baltic ports and the countries of Europe and America is to be extended. A Prague report tells of the European Championship Wrestling Contest. The Soviet wrestler Jal Tornin has won a second victory, beating the Hungarian Ferenc. In the lightweight class, Kalbi, USSR, beat the Greek wrestler Boris in the 6th minute. The medium-weight Soviet wrestler Konstantin Kabaridze had an equally easy victory over the Austrian Kostner. Kotkas, the Soviet heavyweight champion, met one of the strongest referees in Europe, the Swede Anton Senna. Kotkas won on points. So the Soviet team has won 7 bouts out of 9, losing only 2. This year, the sown area in the USSR will increase 25 million acres, which equals nearly half the entire sown area in Canada. Soviet science comes to the aid of the collective farmers who are going all out for a high harvest yield. Lysenko, the president of the Soviet Agricultural Academy, told our correspondent that the Academy unites more than 10 scientific research institutes whose work is of the greatest importance for agricultural development. It is known, for instance, that hybrid seed usually gives a growth which is stronger and more productive. Abroad, however, the use of hybrid seeds is a rare thing, owing to the difficulty of receiving large supplies of hybrid seed quickly. In the USSR, methods have been worked out for the swift delivery of considerable quantities of hybrid wheat seed, especially winter wheat. No less important research is being carried on by Soviet scientists on other seeds, and many of their most important discoveries are being utilized. Nikolai Maximov, Doctor of Science, Director of the Institute of Vegetable Physiology, told our correspondent that the Institute is carrying on extensive research work for raising the yield of various crops. This year, a group of people from the Institute are going to Tajikistan to work out means for fighting the fall of cotton bolls. The Institute has a laboratory for research into new substances assisting the growth of vegetation and its vitality. Boris Gorbatov, Assistant Secretary General of the Union of Soviet Writers, told our representative about some new books being written by Soviet authors. Mikhail Shalahov, known for his novels and Quiet Flows the Don and Soil Upturned, is writing a book entitled They Fought for Their Country. The author has been on many fronts and himself saw many of the biggest battles in the war. Vasily Grossman, who took part in the Battle of Stalingrad, is working on a novel on this theme. Leonid Sobolev has recently finished a new work on the Soviet Navy during the war. Many Soviet writers are finding their subjects in the peacetime labor of the Soviet peoples. Alexander Fadel is writing a novel on the collective farm village today. And finally, Boris Gorbatov said that he himself is working on a novel about the life of that generation whose whole conscious life has been spent under Soviet power. He expects to finish it for the 30th anniversary of the October Revolution. Amayak Sivas, responsible secretary of the Union of Armenian Writers, now visiting Moscow, told our representative that the State Armenian Publishing House intends to issue the selected works of Armenian writers for the 30th anniversary of the October Revolution. The series will consist of 20 volumes. The fourth number of the Soviet literary journal, The New World, contains the beginning of a new novel by Ilya Ehrenberg. The action takes place between 1939 and 1945, and the scene is laid in France, the Soviet Union, the Soviet-German front, and in Germany. The French scenes show how many social groups, particularly those that took an active part in the resistance movement. Half the novel is now ready. The author is now at the point describing the Battle of Stalingrad. Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia will sign a 4-year trade agreement on the 19th. Goods to the value of 3,437 million Czech crowns are to be exchanged in this period. On May 28th, a Sofia regional court will begin examining the case of the puppet premier Tsankov and his accomplices who have taken refuge in Austria. The indictment states that at the end of 1944, when Bulgaria was bending every effort in the struggle against the Hitlerites, Tsankov and his gang tried to force the Bulgarian people to turn their arms on the Soviet army. Lieutenant General Svuridov, vice chairman of the Allied Control Commission in Hungary, has received the noted Hungarian sculptor Kisfaludi Strabel Zsigmond to design the monument to Soviet army men which has been erected on Mount Gellert in Budapest. General Svuridov presented the sculptor with a large silver vase bearing the inscription to Professor Kisfaludi Strabel Zsigmond in gratitude for the erection of a monument to Soviet army men. The sculptor replied that the very fact that he was assigned to design the monument had been a very great reward for him. He said that he had done his best to vindicate his high trust. The resettlement in Hungary of Hungarians residing in Slovakia has begun. It is being conducted on the basis of a corresponding agreement between Czechoslovakia and Hungary. Reuters reports that traffic restrictions have been introduced in five large towns of India: Calcutta, Amritsar, Delhi, Agra, and Peshawar, in view of the resumption of disturbances. Troops and police patrol the streets. Admiral Gelfrich, Commander-in-Chief of the Dutch Navy, will arrive in Britain on Tuesday, along with a group of officers of the Dutch Navy. The invitation was extended by the British Admiralty. Representatives of the Japanese Communist Party have filed a protest with the Home Ministry because, under present conditions, the candidates of the Communist Party cannot campaign. The protest states that on April 6th, the Communist Party candidate Matsumoto was assaulted in Kuwamura. The victim received knife wounds. The protest demands that the Home Ministry turn serious attention to this incident. And that ends this news bulletin, which came to you from the studios of Radio Moscow. Now, here's a review of today's Soviet press. For some time, the Soviet press has been publishing letters addressed to Generalissimo Stalin by farmers of various regions as they enter the countrywide drive in honor of the 30th anniversary of Soviet power. Today's front pages feature a letter from farming personnel of the Ukraine. The authors give the assurance that with selfless labor, they will overcome the difficulties caused by the war and last year's drought, and that they will make 1947 a year of a real upswing in the Republic's agriculture. Pravda, Izvestia, Red Star, and other newspapers comment extensively on this letter. Pravda recalls that in the years before the war, the Ukraine, like the rest of the Soviet Union, developed from a region backward in economy and culture into a flourishing republic with an advanced industry and agriculture outfitted with modern equipment. Prior to the war, the Ukraine accounted for more than one quarter of the Soviet Union's grain production and about 70% of the sugar beet. More than 90,000 tractors, 31,000 harvester combines, and 50,000 trucks helped the farmers. The German fascist vandals caused tremendous damage to the Ukrainian economy. As Izvestia points out today, after the expulsion of the enemy, the Republic had only one-third of its pre-war number of tractors, 2 to 3 times less other farming machinery than before the war, and one-fifth the number of harvester combines. And the difficulties resulting from the war were further aggravated by the drought of 1946. The newspaper will speak of the assistance which the Ukraine receives in its rehabilitation work from the Soviet government and the other nations of this country. Owing to this aid and the devoted work of the collective farmers, the Ukraine last year has sold 82% of its pre-war cultivated acreage. The Republic now has more than 27,000 collective farms and 1,240 machine and tractor stations. This year's spring sowing is moving forward successfully. By the 10th of this month, as Vestia says, more than 10 million acres had been sown. In other words, 1.25 million acres more than by the same date last year. The Sunday Pravda offers readers a letter from a fourth-year student of the Moscow University describing a conversation which she and other students had this week with a group of foreign correspondents who visited the university. When the students asked the correspondents how they felt about President Truman's recent order for a checkup of the loyalty of civil service employees, they replied that this order was directed only against communists. To this one, the student said, "But were the American communists bad fighters in the struggle against fascism?" Whereupon a correspondent replied that they began to be good fighters only after the Germans attacked the Soviet Union. Since it's well known that America entered the war against Germany after Hitlerite Germany attacked the Soviet Union. If the American correspondent who gave this reply informs his readers the same way he tried to inform us, then I don't envy his readers, the student writes. The foreign news discussion in the Sunday Tribune deals with unemployment in the United States, where about 3 million unemployed are now registered, according to the latest statistics. The commentator notes that 1.5 million war veterans received unemployment relief in March this year, as compared with 934,000 in December 1946. Unemployment in America is steadily increasing, he says. 500,000 unemployed have appeared in the country during the past 4 months alone. Moreover, there are sure signs of a new crisis on the horizon, and that will aggravate the unemployment. The book column in today's Trud includes a note by Nikolai Pogodin, the writer, about the Czechoslovak book A Word Before Execution by Julius Fruchik, which has just been translated into Russian. The book was written by the communist journalist in a Gestapo torture chamber. On September 8, 1943, Julius Fruchik was put to death in Berlin. In his review of the book, Nikolai Pogodin declared that these memoirs will ever live because, from beginning to end, they look to the future for which their heroic author perished after expressing the hopes and dreams of millions who had given their lives in the struggle against fascism. Pogodin recalls, in this connection, the many who are still suffering in Spain, Greece, and other countries. In comment on General de Gaulle's latest speech, a true observer notes that French reaction is very enthusiastic over these speeches. The reactionary press is filled with remarks of approval. Vichy men of yesterday are now prepared to declare de Gaulle their bannerhead in the struggle to save law and order. The right-wing weekly Quel Quel responded to de Gaulle's speeches by calling for an immediate coup d'etat. Quite a different appraisal of the speeches is given by left-wing parties and their newspapers. They describe the speeches as dangerous to the Republic, as an open call to split the French people, as a summons to insurrection against democracy for the sake of a one-man dictatorship. The resolute rebuff which democratic circles of France have given the attempts to restore reaction, says the crude commentator, shows that these circles realize the real meaning of de Gaulle's speeches and their danger for the French Republic. Foreign news pages today report the work of the Foreign Minister's Council and also yesterday's press conference at the Soviet Foreign Ministry, at which Deputy Foreign Minister Wyszynski replied to the questions of correspondents about the work of the Minister's Council. And that ends this review of today's Soviet press, which came to you from the studios of Radio Moscow. We continue with a commentary written by Shapilov. Here's what he writes. As one of its favorite objects of slander and fabrications, international reaction chooses the relations between the small democratic countries of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. The reasons for this campaign of slander are plain. The countries of Eastern Europe, which have taken the democratic road of development, have for the first time in history secured an opportunity to pursue an independent home and foreign policy, and have freed themselves from the domination of foreign monopolies. Everyone knows the role played in this by the Soviet Union, whose assistance enabled the small East European states to drive out the German fascist invader and to turn to independent and democratic development. The friendly relations between the USSR and these countries, which have grown up on this basis, do not please certain circles of international reaction. Hence, the constant attempts to slander and defame relations between the Soviet Union and the small countries of Eastern Europe. Even before the war, and before German fascist invasion of the Balkans, the Soviet Union did everything in its power to help these countries protect themselves from German fascist aggression, but without interfering in their domestic life. A good example of this was the Treaty of Friendship and Non-Aggression concluded by the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia on April 6, 1941. However, the pre-war governments of the East European countries, governments made up of fascists and foreign agents, betrayed the interests of the people and handed their territories over to the Hitlerite invader for plunder. It is also common knowledge that the Soviet Union, whose heroic army saved the countries of Eastern and Southeastern Europe from national collapse, is primarily responsible for the restoration of their independent existence. Whereas British troops in Greece and Indonesia set about suppressing the national liberation movement with armed force and establishing reactionary regimes, and while the United States pursued the same policy in the Philippines, The Soviet Union and its army did not interfere in the slightest degree in the domestic affairs of the small countries, but gave the peoples of those lands an opportunity to set up the regimes they saw fit. This principle of respecting the sovereignty and independence of the small East European countries is rigidly adhered to by the Soviet Union in all its post-war relations with them. Nor is this an exception and an exceptional case. In its relations with all democratic countries, the Soviet Union stands for equality and the consolidation of peace, security, and international cooperation. While the joint struggle against Hitlerite Germany was still raging, the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia signed a treaty of friendship, mutual aid, and post-war cooperation on April 11, 1945. One of the provisions of this treaty is that the two states will participate in a spirit of the most sincere cooperation in all international acts aimed at ensuring peace and universal security, and will make their fulcrum contribution to the accomplishment of these lofty aims. So this treaty, like the bilateral treaties concluded earlier by the USSR with Britain, Czechoslovakia, and France, represents a valuable contribution to the struggle for peace and democracy. The Soviet Union has also afforded economic assistance to Yugoslavia and concluded a number of economic agreements with her which fully conform to the interests of both countries. The Soviet government has done a maximum to help Yugoslavia both with raw materials and with industrial crops and other goods. So the Soviet Union's relations with Yugoslavia lack all the elements of discrimination or violation of sovereignty and fully promote the economic and political independence of Yugoslavia. These relations of equality and mutual respect are a striking contrast to the actions of Britain and America towards Yugoslavia, actions which at times amount to open economic and political pressure and seriously infringe on the sovereignty of democratic Yugoslavia. All remember how the American authorities seized Yugoslav vessels on the Danube for purposes of economic and political blackmail, how British and American military aircraft violated the Yugoslav frontiers, and many similar facts. The same parallel may be drawn with regard to democratic Albania. While Britain and America strive to interrupt the independent and democratic development of that small country, deliberately aggravate diplomatic relations with her, violate her waters, and so forth, the Soviet Union upholds the right of the Albanian people to decide their domestic problems themselves without outside interference. Back in December 1942, at the height of the struggle against the German and Italian fascist invaders, the Soviet Union published a declaration about Albanian independence, stating that it did not recognize any claims of Italian imperialism to Albanian territory and that it wished to see Albania liberated from the yoke of fascist invaders. And her independence restored. In November 1945, the Soviet government recognized the Albanian government. Since then, the inalienable sovereign rights of the Albanian people, who won their independence at the cost of heavy losses, have been consistently defended by the Soviet Union at the Paris Peace Conference, in the United Nations Assembly, in the Security Council, and in the Foreign Ministers' Council. For one thing, at its present conference. This same principle of respect for the independence and sovereignty of the small Balkan countries and assistance to their peoples lies at the basis of the Soviet Union's relations with other small countries. The USSR ensured the restoration of Romania's territorial integrity. In view of the severe drought that gripped Romania for 2 years running, the Soviet Union supplied that country in 1945 with 150,000 tons of wheat and 150,000 tons of corn on a reciprocal basis, and granted Romania extra time to make her grain deliveries. Then, in 1946, it announced another 2 years moratorium on Romania's reparation obligations and took other measures to aid that country. When the drought hit Bulgaria, the Soviet Union supplied that country with 3 million tons of corn and 2 million tons of wheat on the same reciprocal terms. Since the end of the war, the Soviet Union has concluded trade agreements with both Bulgaria and Romania, agreements which correspond to the interests of both parties and represent a very substantial contribution to the work of rehabilitating Romania and Bulgaria. For one thing, the Soviet Union has supplied these two countries with the raw materials they need. Another fact which cannot be disregarded is the Soviet Union's struggle at the Paris Peace Conference and later at the New York meeting of the Foreign Ministers Council to see that the terms of the peace treaties with the former enemy countries were democratic. The Soviet Union stood for such treaties as would effectively forestall any new military assaults and at the same time guarantee the vanquished countries the possibility of independent, democratic development. It will be remembered that the British, American, and certain other delegations at the Paris Peace Conference made quite a few attempts to dismember Bulgaria and put the economy of Romania and Bulgaria into the hands of foreign trusts and monopolies. Definite circles in the United States and Britain that try to infringe on the sovereignty and undermine the economic independence of the Balkan countries. The democratic lands of Eastern and Southeastern Europe are keenly interested in a stable and lasting peace in the consolidation of international cooperation, and they see that it is the Soviet Union that heads the struggle for peace. They regard the Soviet Union's consistent and resolute struggle for peace and democracy as a sure guarantee of peace and security. You may remember what Marshal Tito, the Yugoslav Prime Minister, said recently. We are with the Soviet Union because from the Soviet Union we constantly hear the voice of peace, and that corresponds to our desires. Whereas from the West we constantly hear talk about the atom bomb and the menace of war. The nations of the world can find examples of the peace policy of the Soviet Union at every turn, in its position during consideration of international problems in the United Nations organization and in other international bodies and conferences, and the day-by-day manifestation of the Soviet government's foreign policy. This fact plays no small role in steadily strengthening and developing the friendship and close cooperation between the Soviet Union and the small countries of Eastern Europe. You've been listening to a commentary written by Shatilov. It came to you from Moscow. We now present a program of music marking the 9 years since the death of the great Russian singer Theodore Shalyapin. Our first recording is of the Maslay Elegy.
Oh, my God. Oh,